this is a spoiler.
You can't listen to this and not have spoilers.
Kind of notoriously the difficult read. It's like the meaty book, I think, in the literary
circles. That Finnegan's Wake.
Since you have read the whole book, maybe you can offer some kind of view across it or something.
I'll give it a shot. It was difficult for me too. I echoed everything you guys are saying, because kind of like we were saying a second ago, every time you begin to start to get a feel for a chapter and the way he's working, specifically the narration, he's kicked your legs out from underneath you and switches it up in the next chapter. So it's just continually destabilizing in that way. But it's kind of like a big crossword puzzle or something like that, you know, or a big riddle. It's exhausting, but it's also rewarding. That was my experience, at least. You know, as I went through, I was extremely intimidated, but I kept getting hooked at the same time. And I have to admit, you know, as it went on, especially in the final three chapters, I really was enjoying reading the book. In the beginning, I was just intimidated and exhausted. Of course, the whole thing is set up on episodes of The Odyssey, so you have that loose kind of template to guide you a little bit, and you can look for those references in the book, and it'll help you a little bit kind of figure out what's going on, and then not just looking for similarities, but also reasons and places where he decides to switch it up and break from Homer's story. That gives you a little bit of a guide, and then to me, also, one of the most confusing things was the continued references to Irish history, Irish culture, Dublin, stuff I really know absolutely very little about, even though I've been to Dublin. I mean, it was just extremely localized. But at the same time, there's some really universal elements to the story. I mean, Bloom and Stephen throughout the story are dealing with heavy philosophical issues of life and death, of family. And I think the theme of return, I think, is probably the biggest theme to me, that the epic of return and the cyclic view of history, starting in the very beginning with Bloom at home and then finally coming back home. It comes full circle when you get to Molly's final soliloquy there. And it's extremely difficult to talk about the book as a whole. I mean, I can talk about episodes, but I mean, to try and sum the whole thing up, I mean, it's really hard. I don't know if you guys had that experience.
Well, I wonder if that was his purpose.
I don't think you need to know that much. I took a course on Irish history as an undergrad, which doesn't really give me much of a heads up on this. I mean, the figures that they bring in, you don't really need to know that much. You just need to have a basic context of the Irish gentry would help, and then like knowing about British rule and Catholicism. But you don't really need to know much about who Niall Houlihan was or who Parnell. You don't need to know those people really to get where Joyce is situating the reader and the characters politically.
Yeah, there's definitely a culture that is built in, you know, the songs and the voices and the, you know, it's pulling from a rich cultural history that has an integrity, and you don't really know, but maybe someone else reading it. Oh yeah, that's the bar song. If you sing this whenever you walk out of a bar, I'm seeing this too. That was a theme that I'm glad you said ran throughout. There's a lot that I've been interested in just noting with reincarnation and these ways of seeing, I guess, a couple of generations deep through one person's viewpoint. There's a lot of talk about the inversion and flexifying of human culture, and there's a lot of interesting stuff there. I wanted to get on that at some point, that cyclical nature.
Maybe my inversion.
So there's this passage where it was talking about a mother who, I think the line, like, the child was from her own watery blood. This visual sense, the child is going into her and pulling out some substance and then carrying that forward. And then she just dies as like an unknown person. And this child kind of carries it forth and is interacting in the world. And so there's this kind of like compression and expansion of the human experience that I feel like is being talked about.
Especially centered around birth and death. Like those are key elements of the cyclicality or whatever you want to call it, but also the repetitions in the text of memory, where the stream of consciousness type text, where you'll see some thought come up multiple times, and it's kind of, especially like Bloom when he ruminates over his wife, or in the case of Stephen, ruminating over his, not praying over his mother's grave and her deathbed. And
I was interested in that particularly about him not kneeling at her death, not kneeling with his mother when she died. That was an important concept to Joyce, because that's in defiance of Christianity. Do you think of time this was written and where?
That's another aspect of Joyce, definitely. And also considering how his, if you want to call it atheism, I don't know if you would call it that, but
yes,
his atheism, let's just call it that, how it differs from Mulligan's. Mulligan is sort of a foil and kind of an alter ego to Stephen. And Mulligan is kind of this crude or crass version of iconoclasm where it's turned into a joke and therefore it kind of makes the effect less potent, where Stephen is more defiant as a moral choice and its effect at the end of her life where it's unrecoverable. It's weird. It's a strange comparison.
Comparing who, you mean? Mulligan and Stephen?
Yes. In terms of their versions of atheism.
I see Mulligan more like a coon in a way. That's kind of lightening it a little too much. But I don't know. For some reason, I just feel like he's definitely the other side.
So I'd say that Mulligan, on one hand, is the more admirable aspect of him. Okay, so the less admirable aspect of him is that he's kind of like a frat boy who, or a dilettante who... He knows a lot. You can tell he's like incredibly intelligent, but then just makes fun of everything. But then the more like admirable aspect of that is that he plays on this archetypal figure that goes back to the Celtic culture of like the trickster figure who kind of pushes at the fringes of, you know what I mean? Like he kind of disturbs the order a bit. And so you kind of need him there. He brings in humor, but at the same time, it's a very annoying type of humor.
He's not very self-reflective.
Mulligan, too, he's somebody for whom nothing is sacred, and he's the usurper in Stephen's house. He's almost like a fake Stephen to me. He thinks a lot of things that Stephen also thinks, but he thinks them in a way in which they're never taken seriously. When he's doing his fake mass, the fake transubstantiation in the beginning of the book at the first chapter, and he makes the cross with his shaving bowl and his razor blade. One of the professors I was listening to was talking about that, and he was describing it as representing Christianity as a cross between sadism and narcissism. Stephen also thinks that, but to Buck, it's a joke. It's always, let's go out and get drunk. Whereas to Stephen, you know, this is life. He wants to figure it out, and he takes philosophy seriously.
It's not just Christianity, but Catholicism, like the whole ritual element going into it. Because this is one of the important things where it's good to know Irish history a little bit, is that Ireland mostly is caught between the crown of British rule, of imperial rule, and Catholicism, which has become politicized and kind of the anti-imperialist. But it seems like figures like Joyce were kind of the outsider figures that didn't really identify with either side. This reminds me a lot of also the poet Patrick Kavanagh. I could see them being sympathizers.
Well, I'm a little more reluctant with my teen percentage of reading this. I don't really know the arcs. What I did pick up on, though, was that there was two versions of atheism that I heard come up, and that was between Buck Mulligan and Stephen Davis. Is that right?
Yes.
You guys were talking about a certain kind of like, you know, want to go out and get drunk and kind of, you know, giving a thumb at philosophy, maybe. Philosophy and the Buddhist practices may be at odds, and that kind of trying to figure life out versus go out and have an experience. That's just a connection that I've made up, but I don't know if it's stronger in the book or...
I think it's open for question whether Mulligan is a legitimate, whatever that is, whatever a legitimate or genuine atheist would be, because it becomes his own self-parody when he's playing, poking fun at Catholicism.
Yeah.
And so insistently, without, like we were saying earlier, without any introspective or any depth. In fact, isn't his first name Moloch or something like that, or the name of a Jewish false god? Can't remember what his first name was. No, his first name is Buck. They called him Moloch later on, but
they call him Malachi a lot.
Malachi, that's it. Malachi, which is isn't Malachi one of the false gods in Jewish? I might be mixing up Malachi with Moloch, so that I might be both. Okay,
I think it's what's important not to go off or anything, but I think it's important to look at the context of when Joyce wrote this and where Joyce himself is coming from, because this book is considered, if not one of the greatest ones ever written in Western civilization, or at least it's considered in modern times, if not the greatest. And so I think it's important to look at the context, not just of the history, which granted it's hard for us because we aren't necessarily great Irish historians, but to look at the context of the time and where he was coming from and why he did this. the way he did it. Like, this book takes place during the course of a day.
It goes from early morning to night. And I thought that was really, I don't really know what to say about it other than that it was interesting.
It, when you look at it in terms of time, it takes a very small piece of time, one day, 24 hours, and he goes through enormous, deep, profound, expansive experiences within himself and, you know, around him. I mean, I just think that, I mean, that may have been what made it, you know, initially considered a great piece of work there. In terms of philosophy within it and in terms of Joyce's background, to be going up against the Catholic Church and to be going against Christianity was a big thing at that time, particularly in Ireland. And that was really critical to him. He was turning his back on the church. He was turning his back on religion and turning it toward art and turning it toward poetry.
He's turning his back on pretty much everything in Ireland, like everything. He's turning his back on the gentry, which is where I found that the most interesting, because he's turning his back on basically the intellectuals of Ireland at the time who believed in the Irish Renaissance and that there should be a nationalist kind of art style, Yeats being the key figure of that. I agree completely. Catholicism is a big element of that in Christianity and turning against that, but also everything else he's turning against, you know?
He and Yeats were also friends, though, too.
Were they? I thought they were at first, and then they had a big falling out, and this was...
Yeah, maybe they did. In the context of modernism, I know that while this book was being written, he was sending the chapters in the mail to Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot. They, in turn, really reoriented their work, The Wasteland and The Cantos, both in reaction to this book. He was pulling off what they were trying to do.
Towards the end of his life, when he wrote Finnegan's Wake, he like alienated himself from all those people and himself. He rejected his own work. He went and dove off into the deep. Portrait of an Artist of a Young Man was pretty much universally accepted. And then this book was written and it was accepted by some of the more progressive, you know, like Ezra Pound. And then when he wrote Finnegan's Wake, it was like nobody accepted it. It's just like, what's going on?
I had a question, which is, just has to do with the obscene part of it. It was considered an obscene work.
Yeah, later in the book, in the Circe chapter and in the Penelope chapter at the end, apparently the Molly Bloom monologue at the end of the book was really what drove the censors crazy.
Oh, really?
And in Nausicaa. For one thing, Joyce was characteristically, you can call this Joycean, is this embrace of, like, not just scatology, but just the human body as a vulgar thing that shits and farts and masturbates and, you know, like, excrements bodily fluids. And he goes into at length in describing these elements of the body, which was offensive to those who prefer to think of the body as something sacred. Also in Nausicaa, you know, he masturbates to a lady who shows him basically a stranger, but they show it from the women's perspective. And I think at a time, I wouldn't call Joyce a feminist, but he certainly is sympathetic to women. And tries to show from the women's perspective that, oh no, women are not just necessarily chaste, that they also have sexual desires. And right. I think that was controversial because, you know, what other book writes about women and having sexual desires?
But also that's very counter to Eliot. I mean, Eliot had a very strong religious part of his work that was very new and unusual to find a work considered obscene. And as I understand it, it had trouble getting published.
But anyway, I wanted to go back to something Laura said about the timeline of the book and having it all take place within one day. My biggest way of wrapping my head around the book at this point is understanding it as an attempt to exalt the daily routine. To me, it seems more and more reading it, that's what Joyce wants to do. His whole project is about making our day-to-day lives. How can you make Ulysses out of Leopold Bloom? You know, how can you make a grand adventure out of just going about your normal routine and doing the normal things, eating breakfast and picking your nose and, you know, as low to the ground as you want to go. I really think that's a crucial way of understanding this novel, is realizing that he wants us to find some kind of a religious aspect to just living our daily lives and to see that in the way that we see the Odyssey, you know, as an epic.
I'll be honest, at first when I was reading this, I thought this is one of the themes I want to talk about, is actually the theme of the allegorical nature of the book and the fact that he compares himself to Ulysses, Bloom to Ulysses, and kind of builds the narrative off of that. At first, it wasn't working for me, and I thought, oh, how pompous, you know, like compare this character to a and your book. Like, the whole undertaking of writing a novel already has some kind of air of pomposity to it.
Wait, to write any novel or this novel?
Both, but especially this novel, because it's such a, I mean, it's such an undertaking. But the reason why, what I find really, I hesitate to use a virtuous, but for lack of a better word, what I find virtuous about it, what salvageable about this is that it is kind of a mock heroic epic. So it's, on the one hand, it's very glorious and sympathetic to the characters. And on the other hand, it's comic. It's making fun of the characters. It's making fun of the entire Enterprise. And it's acknowledging its own pomposity, you know. It still is epic in its proportions. And it's, I mean, like you were saying earlier, it's one of the most acclaimed novels of all time. And certainly there are heroic aspects of these protagonists. And like I said, Joyce portrays them in a sympathetic light, but he also portrays them as flawed characters and characters that laugh at themselves and that are full of self-doubt. This other theme I wanted to get on, I wanted to discuss, is how the impotence is the driving force behind the protagonist, and not just the protagonist, but most of the major characters in the book. It seems like impotence, onanism and impotence, are like the two big aspects of these characters. They begin their journey, like Homer does, I'm sorry, not Homer, Odysseus, by being usurped from their homeland. Loom bowls over his wife, who he knows he's being cuckolded, right? And he even at one point sees Blazes Boylan and stalks him and follows him down, but then fails to intervene and fails to confront him. And Stephen, it's more impotence in terms of his intellectual undertakings, where like he tries to defend his point, but gets knocked down and then is working under this anti-Semitic, is surrounded by, well, I guess both characters are surrounded by anti-Semitic figures. And, you know, I wish I wrote down all the examples of impotence, because I know there's more and there's a lot of better ones. And for some reason, those are the best I can think of at the moment. When Bloom commits onanism on his wife.
What is onanism? I'm sorry, that word's come up twice now.
Well, it's kind of like masturbation, but it's from like the Old Testament. There's this guy named Onan who sleeps with his sister or something, and then like instead of ejaculating her, he ejaculates outside of her. So it's like infertile. Your seed is being spilled on it infertilely, basically.
Okay, got it. Maybe colloquially would be called pulling out.
Pulling out, there you go.
I'm sorry, so this is happening with Leopold Bloom, is that right? And that was another example.
Yeah.
For me, I think impotence isn't quite right, though, because I think the big point Joyce makes is that he is an impotent. And it's more of the block is something other than impotence. Because as you see with Gertie McDowell later in the novel, when he masturbates, and then when he's looking in the Cersei chapter on Blazes Boylan and Molly Bloom and masturbating through the keyhole, you see that he clearly can consummate the marriage if he so chooses, but it's more grief that's blocking him than impotence. And I think the same thing is true with Stephen. Grief over his mother and an attachment to that is blocking him in his philosophical investigations.
I guess when I say impotence, I don't mean like literally, I mean more metaphorically speaking.
Right.
I mean, obviously he has semen, but it's more the fact, like even in that scene where with Gertie, they both encounter each other sexually through a substitute, through some, like it's like clearly castrated sexual encounter. And this is another theme that comes up that's really clear to me, is the absent figure and how that's also a driving force. So in the case of Gertie and Bloom is mulling over his wife, who he knows has just copulated, and then this girl, Gertie, has just broken up. And so they both kind of know, okay, well, we have this dream of love. They're both sad, and they're both attracted to each other because they're sad. And so they become a substitute or a compromise for love that has been lost. The sexual encounter becomes a infertile one, literally and metaphorically.
So I have a question. Are we saying that this is the overall, I mean, no, this is an extremely complicated book, as we know, but is this the overall theme of this book?
Oh, no. There's lots of overall, I mean, I think this is a major theme. Okay, here's the themes I wrote down. Impotence, absence, false father, and then also the Joycean idea of love, and then return was another one, and then the use of allegory. Those are just the stuff I noticed. And I thought impotence and the absent figure were two ones that really interested me. And I don't know if impotence is the right word. It's just the word I know, like, you know, psychoanalysts use when they're describing some kind of desires that are unable to be met.
Right. Daniel, were you the one that said you were talking about that lecture in the Great Courses or whatever it was? What did that professor say about this theme of impotence or the obscenity of or Bloom's problems with consummating and Molly? He addressed that at all?
To me, if we're going to find an overall theme of the book, I think it's that there is no overall theme. And if you want to push that into the cyclical view of history or the epic of return, I think you can do that. I think they're all part of the same thing. His position, which I think is extremely interesting, and I'll press that again or point you guys back to it. If you ever want to listen to something on modernism, that is definitely the series I would go to. But anyway, I think one of the challenges of the book is an identity in flux and the membrane or the contrast between the self and the not self, what's outside and what's inside. Because one of the things that seems to happen over and over throughout the book is that a statement is made or an epiphany is reached or some profundity is come to, and it will be immediately contradicted or downplayed or satirized or, you know, just scorned by some other character. So that you have this over and over kind of situation where you seem to take a step forward and then it's taken a step back, so that, you know, there's always this give and take. But at the same time, it seems like the profundity or the epiphany that's reached is never entirely done away with. For instance, the chapter, I forget what the code name for it is or whatever, but when he's talking to the citizen in the pub and he's trying to... Bloom's talking to the citizen in the pub, and the citizen he's the guy who's defender of Ireland.
Cyclops.
Well, it is the Cyclops chapter, yeah. He's trying to express the position of universal love, and he's trying to eliminate the Irish-English dichotomy that the citizen is putting forward, the us and them. And Bloom makes this pretty eloquent speech. I'm not going to take the trouble to find it right now, but he makes a pretty elegant pitch for universal love and for, you know, basically loving your neighbor as yourself. And then immediately the narrator breaks in and basically just makes fun of it right then and there.
Yeah, I love that part.
The same time, I don't think that does away with what Bloom has just said. And I think that's the kind of thing that happens over and over, is that from what I understand, from what I read in Joyce criticism, there's a huge dividing line about what is ironic in the book and what isn't. And especially about Molly Bloom's final chapter, there's just a whole bunch of critics who say, you know, we need to take this ironically. Joyce is making fun of all of this. And then a bunch that find it sincere. I personally found it sincere, but the professor in that lecture I was pointing to, he was trying to make the case that the book affirms yes and no, and that's basically the whole point, is that you have identities that are in process, that are in flux, that, you know, everything outside of you is also you. Everything in the daily stream of conscious, there's no inner sanctum that you come back to. It's all moving around, you know, the stream of consciousness is moving around the rocks and the branches that are your daily rituals, that are your daily interactions. And that's a part of you as much as it isn't.
A million things that jumped out at me when you were saying that, but the main thing that I was thinking about was the chaos that exists in this writing. And it's curious to me why Joyce wrote this way, because it's very different from other writings or other work at this time. I keep thinking about the context of when he wrote. Even today, when we find more chaotic writings, it throws the reader. So I'm wondering, when you talk about those moments where there is an epiphany and then the next moment they're making fun of the epiphany, and then the next moment he's going off somewhere else, I'm wondering what Joyce's goal was, what he was trying to say at those moments and throughout this whole piece. The chaos, it's really like a big chaotic labyrinth.
I think Daniel's earlier point about the identity being in flux is part of what he's trying to say. I mean, it's really clear to me in Proteus. That's where it becomes like, you know, Proteus being the god of sea changes, and Stephen Dedalus contemplating about what is identity and you know, what is real, and how can I determine the real when it's changing all the time. But of course, Dedalus is being very philosophical. And later on, Loom is going to be like the antidote to that head in the clouds philosophical approach. But also, I get the sense personally that the reason why there are so many writing styles and it feels so chaotic is because, Daniel, before when we were on Beckett, you were talking about how Joyce is an additive writer. I think it just has to do with his writing style, his writing method. Like, I think he is an experimental writer. And so, let's try this and let's try this, you know? And so, he's just trying to push writing to the limits. And that's why, you know, in Finnegan's Wake, it gets way too far out there for most readers. And I mean, I've read other books by... He is one of the best prose stylists, probably the best prose stylist in all writers in history. Like, especially if you find this out when you read... which chapter is that? The one about birth, the oxen and the sun. And he just goes through, he just, like, every paragraph is a different prose style completely. He'll write in the style of, like, a early English, and then he'll write in the style, like, a Chaucerian language, and then he'll write in the tongue of Dickens, and, like, he's just mimicking all these different writing styles.
That was the most difficult one for me.
I found it hilarious, but certain parts of it anyways. But I could only take so much of it, and then I was like, okay.
Yeah, that's going to that Zen mode.
Yeah, it was amazing, but yeah, it was extremely difficult.
Just of this whole work, when I think about it. I mean, I guess because I'm very stuck on this idea of him revolting against the Catholic Church and against Christianity, these worlds that are very well structured, very black and white, this work is very not that, very anti that.
There's one theme that we haven't discussed that I want to get to, and that's the theme of the absent individual, which I think is really interesting. For the two protagonists, first of all, they don't come into contact with each other until The Oxen and the Sun, the chapter about birth. And yet, Bloom is in contact with the father, who's also absent from Stephen's life, pretty much, because he's, again, there's an absent figure. The mother, who's been he's been bereaved of, has driven him to become basically a drunkard. And so we have these two figures who the reader associates already with a kind of father-son relation between the two, because the first section is Telemachus, you know, and then we figure out Bloom is kind of the Ulysses figure. And then there's also the absence of the gap or separation between Bloom and Molly, or is it Malloy? I don't even know. And then their son, who they lost. And then... one of the most interesting chapters for me was the one where I think it's Scylla and Charybdis. No, it's not that. The one where Simon is defending his thesis about Shakespeare, who he's not entirely sure of. You know which one I'm talking about, right? And he talks about how Shakespeare, and they keep on bringing up Hamlet and Shakespeare's father. And maybe because I've been reading the play, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, the Shakespearean part. It's really intrigued me a lot more. But the idea of the absent figure is this driving force in a lot of these characters. I didn't know if you had any thoughts about that or if that's even something that came up in your mind. But to me, it was really interesting.
Yeah, I think it is too. That's Scylla and Charybdis, I think is the chapter.
That was one of the most interesting chapters for me. That one, and I really liked Proteus a lot. That was the first chapter that I really got into the book. But I think his theory... is really fascinating. I put over here, but it's really complex. I can't really go into it in detail. And
yeah, neither can I. I mean, that was one I remember I kind of investigated his theory of Hamlet when I first read it, but I didn't linger on that one a lot, so I don't know if I have as much to say.
It was basically that, if I can recap it correctly, that William Shakespeare lost his own son before he wrote Hamlet. And so... Shakespeare becomes the substitute for his father for the ghosts. And so Shakespeare is actually speaking to Hamlet, who is the substitute for Shakespeare's son. So the ghost becomes the substitute for Shakespeare, and Hamlet becomes the substitute for, what's his son's name, Hamnet or something? And so it's like Shakespeare is trying to speak to his son or channel his son through his play. Also, the idea of like giving birth to a work of art or like a play or whatever, and the creative act taking place through that is really interesting. And again, I'm reminded of the chapter with Garrity and Bloom, because they're both connecting to each other, or almost connecting. They're not quite, because he masturbates into the sand through absent figures, and then substituting, they become the substitute through each other. But it's never complete. The union is never complete. Shakespeare has to come up with an imaginary figure in order to reach his son and and Hamlet comes to his father through a ghost. I always find these gaps between these figures. These figures are very alienated from each other. Even Bloom and Stephen are very, they never can reach each other completely. And so there's a tragic element to this book, tragic thread running out throughout the book of these characters that are alienated from each other or estranged from each other and never quite able to reach each other, but they desire each other.
That does play into one thing that I wanted to ask you guys about. One of the most quoted lines is Stephen's line, "History is a nightmare from which I'm trying to awake." And I think that does play somewhat into your theme of the absent loved one or the absent individual, because both Bloom and Stephen are haunted throughout the novel, Stephen by his mother, Bloom by his dead son. And I was wondering, that's one of the questions that's lingered with me about the novel is how to understand that statement, "History is a nightmare from which I'm trying to awake." Because considering that, you know, the cyclical Viconian view of history is all over this novel, what does that mean for that statement? Is it a statement about personal history? Is it a statement about literary history? And in what way? I mean, how did you guys feel about that?
I was just thinking about that idea of being, you know, haunted by history. I was just thinking about that connectivity. Because for me, that was something that came up, like feeling that historical weight or wanting to get shed of that nightmare, I think is this empathic undertaking because you're opening yourself up to more massive information and knowledge, and it constantly seems to kind of like force into yourself this new knowledge. You can't unforget it, right? And there's this little bit that stuck out to me, and it's this theme. It says it like that. Eternal Return calls it, or they says, they call it reincarnation. That we all lived before on the earth thousands of years ago or some other planet. They say we have forgotten it. Some say they remember their past lives. And for me, that notion that you can remember and the idea of understanding and reading is this kind of remembering of different stories and putting together a narrative and finding yourself the kind of nexus for that narrative to come out and trying to understand your part in it, I think maybe that it's a feeling that I really want to see explored because I feel like it's in there, or maybe it's just something I'm focused on. This notion that you could be bringing in history through yourself and then find yourself at odds with something that you kind of made or grown and not knowing. There's this other line, it was about the ineluctable modality of the visible.
Yeah, that's in the Proteus.
And that notion of, you know, ineluctable, you don't choose it. And then the modality, the being sense of it, the sight of it. There's something to that also with a nightmare. It's something that you don't opt to have a nightmare. You don't opt to be or sense the world or order in a primary way what you come across, though you may reorder it in a schematic way in secondary thinking and, you know, dreaming even and talking to people. But you kind of have this like pressure that is the outside world and again, like kind of compresses into you and becomes a part of you. And then you expand it and maybe, I don't know, go out drinking and don't care and just want to throw it all off and be like, no, this is the real world right now. There's no history in a beer. You know, there's just like merriment and dancing, and I can see those two opposite sides of these characters maybe playing out. But again, I really don't feel authentic enough in the book to.
That was a great response, really perceptive. I have three responses: one to Shane, what Shane just said; one to an answer to Daniel's question; and a third one that's just my own thoughts. So, Shane, you talked about nightmares, and later on, and the passage is a nightmare from which we can't awake. I'm also reminded of keep on citing The Oxen and the Sun because I read that, you know, recently. But there's a part in that where Stephen is drunk and he's terrified of thunderstorms. And he thinks that the voice of God is reprimanding him for his mother for not directly, they don't ever say this, but says something like along the lines of the blasphemy. But you know it's because of his mother that he never prayed at his mother's bedside. Interestingly, I read that Joyce also was terrified. He had a phobia of thunderstorms. So Stephen Dedalus is rationally, he's an atheist. The voice of God still comes through him in like as a form of guilt And so I think also the mother stands in as a figure. There's a lot of metaphorical figures, like the blind man was one who's kind of, he represents Ireland, you could say. The mother represents the passing down of history to the son, or tradition to the son, and the son rejecting that history. And that's like, that's what I read into that. And so like the personal, so now to answer the second response, which is, I'm segueing here, about whether it's personal or whether it's, would you ask if it's personal or if it's like the history is personal or if it's historical? I think it's both, because he uses the personal stories of the characters in order to reflect broader, the macrocosm of history. So in that passage, he's, that's with, what's his name? Haynes. Isn't Haynes the one that said that when he's blaming all Ireland's problems on history? Originally, it was used to talk about history in general. And I think that it is in some way a reflection on Ireland in the present moment, where Ireland's trying, Ireland's history is just one tragedy after another. That's all Irish history is, basically. It's really bleak. And so living in Ireland or growing up in Ireland and knowing their history and trying to escape it, but being unable to, that's, I think, as a reflection on that, but also more specifically, a reflection on the ruminations of the characters, in this case, Daedalus ruminating over his mother. And so they both kind of reflect each other. And then here's my third response. And that's that, now I'm not that perceptive, but Bloom actually is more of a present figure and is mulling over the present less than over the past, because he is thinking, oh, right now I'm being cuckolded and right now this is happening. And then the very first scene that introduces Bloom is a very sensual scene about food consumption and smells and just taking in the scenes around him. And then every time he's like, right now this is what's going on. Right now this is what's going on. Whereas Daedalus has no sense of presence. He's either mulling over the past or worried about the future. And so I don't really know what to take of that and why he gave the father figure the presence, why he gave the son figure the past and the future. I don't know what to make of that. I was thinking about Cronus, and but that's not really relevant, I don't think, about Cronus devouring his son. That's like the reverse of that.
Well, one of the things I was wondering about that was, because I know Stephen Dedalus is a stand-in for James Joyce in Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, and to some extent in this book too. And so I was wondering, well, is that Joyce's own position that history is a nightmare that he's trying to awaken from? I guess where I'm at with it right now is that I think that that's part of Stephen's whole problem, maybe, is that he's fighting the wrong battle in that way. History as a cycle. What Bloom has to teach him in this way is Bloom has found meaning in the minutiae of everyday life. He's found meaning in eating a kidney, in watching pigeons, in, you know, every little thing that he does. Whereas Stephen keeps trying to look for meaning outside of the present. He keeps trying to find some kind of transcendental meaning. Whereas Bloom, on the other hand, is very much rooted in his everyday happenings. He's very much rooted in what surrounds him, in the people that surround him, in his life. And I think that's part of what fascinated Joyce with Judaism in this novel, is that's a big part of their tradition, you know, that all of the daily rituals, you know, God is in the details, all of the little things that they do in order to sanctify, you know, your daily life. And then, like we were talking about earlier, you know, of course, that's contradicted too, because Bloom is a lapsed Jew. He does, he eats pork and, you know, he violates all kinds of tenets, but, you know, that's part of the give and take of all of it. And Stephen keeps wanting to escape the circle, but in a circle, no point of meaning or narrative can really take precedence over any other. And so I think his attempt to escape is actually a wrong desire, I guess, or, he's looking at it the wrong way. What he needs to find is something like what Bloom has, where if there's any meaning, if there's any plot to life, it's to be found in what we do. We have to make the epic out of all of the little things. You can't find it in the transcendent. You can't find it in some distant linear kind of way where we're all moving towards this destination and that destination is going to redeem everything. I've heard this book called a theodicy at times. And in that way, it kind of makes sense, I think. Like, it's an apology for the everyday, you know, the picking your nose and the farting and all of that. It's finding all of that stuff, you know, the little bits that a human life is made out of. You know, if there's any plot, if there's any meaning, it's going to be found there. And Joyce is trying to bring us back to that mode of finding each value in the little things.
That sounds like a really good summing up point, but I do, the way you just said that, although I do want to bring up one last thing that I wanted to talk about, and that's Joyce's conception of love. Have any of you read anything else by Joyce?
No, not.
Okay, so I've only read The Dubliners, which actually I liked it more than Ulysses, but that's because it's more concise and easier to follow. It's actually really, really easier to follow than this, but I'm like surprised they're written by the same person. He uses a lot of the same characters in that book, but I noticed a commonality between there's this really poignant vignette in the very last story called The Dead. It's about this character and his husband, or this husband and wife, and the husband sees his wife sitting at a pose listening to music in like a sense of reverie and has this kind of wish for his wife that she marry somebody else because she would have been happier. But he loves her. Like, it's really strange because I noticed that a lot of parallels. His name is Lynn, I think. The name of the, or no, is it Gary? I don't remember the name of the character. Oh, Gabriel. That was his name. Gabriel, and his wife's name was Greta. And I feel like Joyce has, he has this weird combination of this platonic love and then erotic love and kind of oscillates between the two. But it's always, it seems like both this character and Bloom have a romance that's kind of idealized for their wife, but at the same time rooted in the real and in the authentic. Where, like, for instance, I think part of the reason why he doesn't want to intervene with Boylan is because he's thinking, well, I want her to be happy. And also, his wife seems to genuinely love him, even though she is sleeping with someone else. It's like disentangling their erotic from their relationship with each other. I actually was really reminded a lot of, from this book, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, like Teresa and Tomas and their relationship, in that Tomas tries to disentangle, he tries to separate sexual love from romantic love, I guess, because they care about each other despite the fact that they have infidelities. There's a lot of other commonalities I noticed, but at the moment I can't think of them.
Yeah, I think of that one all the time. For some reason, that was one of the books that we read that really stayed with me. And I'd like to read something else by him at some point.
It's because he has these concepts that he repeats that, like, now they're stuck in my brain and they keep coming back and I'm like, oh, this reminds me of this.
This is a tremendous read.